I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week's cover of Newsweek magazine asks the question in words that are meant to either terrify or delight. Is gay marriage next? It's actually a question that was raised in last week's Supreme Court decision, which overturned the Texas sodomy law. Justice Scalia, in his dismissive dissenting opinion, asks, what justification is there now for denying the benefits of marriage to homosexual couples? It may be the first and only time that gay rights advocates agree with this judge. At least they're asking the same question. Is gay marriage next, or is same-sex marriage next? For many, it is a natural next step in social equality. After all, the Canadians are doing it, and they haven't gone to hell. Yet. Gay couples can get a civil union in Vermont. They'll soon be able to register the union at the Cook County Courthouse in Illinois. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court is also poised to offer some form of legal sanction. So, Connection listeners, is it time to bar the doors and hide our sons and daughters because now the homosexuals want to marry our children? Or are the courts simply catching up with where society's been for some time? And let's back up a little bit. Where is America in its puzzling out in the place of gay rights? Is there still a culture war? Or did one side finally win? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me today, here in the studio, E.J. Graff. She's author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution. She's also a visiting scholar at the Brandeis Women's Studies Research Center. Welcome to The Connection, E.J.
Thank you for having me.
And Jonah Goldberg is joining us from Washington. He's the editor-at-large of the web magazine National Review Online. He's also the media critic for the American Enterprise magazine. Jonah, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I'm going to ask you for a little bit of Washington translation here. When Justice Scalia refers to the ruling in terms of a culture war, what is it exactly that he's talking about?
Well, I mean, we've been talking about a culture war for at least 20 years. I think the term became popular in the Reagan years, although my guess is that we've been talking about culture wars with different labels for the entire history of the United States. What constitutes the culture war may change from time to time, but there's always been a sort of red states versus blue thing going on in this country. But he's right. He's saying, in effect, that at least on this aspect, at least on the front that is fought over gays, Scalia was absolutely correct. The Supreme Court did come down essentially on the side of gays in the culture war. And there are a lot of people, myself included, Jeffrey Rosen at the New Republic and others, who think that the Supreme Court could have decided this case, could have overturned these sodomy laws, for example, without necessarily joining sides in the culture war. If you read Justice O'Connor's separate opinion, she voted with the majority, but she wrote a separate opinion. She basically took the narrow approach and said, let's overturn this based on equal protection law, equal protection doctrine, which says that you can't have a law that affects one group of people different than another group of people. But the majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy is this sweeping, gaseous thing full of sort of stuff about defining your own place and space and time and your role in the universe and all of this sort of stuff, which, even if it has nothing to do with gays, still sounds like the sort of moral relativism that the right side of the, and I mean capital R right, the conservative side of the culture war despises. And
so culture war means that whether we're talking about Roe v. Wade or abortion or women's rights or gay rights or whatever, each one of those topics exists under the umbrella of the culture war.
I think so. I think another way to think about it is ever since the Enlightenment, Western civilization has had this internal tension between self-expression and self-discipline. And you could say that one side of the culture war, the left side of the culture war, cares much more about self-expression, personally defined self-expression, what have you, than the right side, which cares much more about sort of self-discipline and order. And I think these things play out across a whole spectrum of different issues.
E.J. Graff, do you see this as a battle in a cultural war?
I'm hesitating here for a second because I would define the history of the discussion entirely differently. I'm not sure I see it at all, as a discipline versus liberty debate. But I think the discussion we're having right now about lesbians and gay men is more in the tradition of capitalism, and is an individual free to make their place in the world if they are free to make their living in the world. In other words, if you do not need your entire extended family to make a living, if you do not have to inherit property to make a living, if you don't have to be trained by your father in farming techniques, if you can go out and find your own talents and exploit them and make a living as an individual and then make your emotional life based entirely on your emotions, not on your need for a market partner, not on your need for someone to take the goods to market and bring in the eggs and all of that, then you have an entirely different set of social choices.
But the social conservatives, EJ, wouldn't see it that way at all. They see this in very strong moral terms that, you know, begins with the proposition that homosexuality is evil and then goes from there.
Yes, I think that is how they see it. And
so
I'm saying that's one side of the argument.
They're not arguing the capitalist side, for example. They're not looking at it as much, with the exception of some of the libertarians, in terms of individual rights as much as they are looking at it in terms of moral rights, right?
Yes, I think I see the Lawrence decision, as much as I would definitely consider myself a progressive and to the left of the center. I more see the gay rights victories in a libertarian tradition that we have in this country a sense that individuals should be free to make their own choices about how to live. I mean, 88% of the country, according to the Gallup poll in May, now believes that gay people should be perfectly free to make their living without being fired from their jobs for being gay. You should be... You know, that they're in favor of anti-discrimination laws at work. I think the idea that you should be able to love who you love is very much in sync with you should be able to work from your talents.
So come back to Jonah's point, though, about...
Is this a culture war?
Not so much whether or not it's a culture war, but whether or not the justices went into the area of culture in making their decision, whether or not there was something more subjective than objective in deciding the merits of the Lawrence versus Texas case, because that's what's got people. It seems to me, correct me if you disagree, but it seems to me that's what's got people talking. That the justices have gone beyond just saying no, the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. The justices went to the point of making some of the arguments that gay rights advocates were making 10 or 15 years ago themselves.
I think I want to say two things in response to that. One is it was a breathtaking decision. I think it astonished everybody, including all the gay civil rights lawyers that I know. It was really beautiful. It was really much broader language than any of us expected. And I don't know anyone who's quite touched ground since. So I really want to start by saying that is true. On the other hand, I think it's possible to read that decision and to say that looking at the other decisions they've made in the past 10 years, then to say that in a way what they're doing is privatizing the culture war. And I'm putting culture war in quotes. Mm-hmm. They're saying the government has no place taking a side here. The government has no place saying there should be criminal laws against what you do in the privacy of your own bedroom, as long as you're not out in the street scaring the horses. But on the other hand, the government should not come in and say the Boy Scouts must say it's okay to be gay. And I can hear some of my friends yelling at me for phrasing it that way. So let me say, I don't think that's what was being asked of the Boy Scouts. But you see what I'm saying. They're saying government's not making these decisions. People are making these decisions. That's why I say it can be seen as a libertarian decision.
Jonah, let me hear from you on this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with a lot of what is it, EJ?
That's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't disagree with a lot of what she says, although I would frame it very differently. I mean, I don't see this as necessarily having a lot to do with capitalism and defining people as economic actors. That sounds like a tradition or a way of looking at this that I just don't see it in. But that's part of this whole debate, is that this is a desperate struggle for getting the ruling metaphor for how to talk about gay people in general. People on the sort of gay rights side of this argument are very eager to talk about gays as if they fit neatly and perfectly into an analogy with black people in this country.
I would never do that, not to interrupt.
But there is, if you look at the, for example, on the op-ed page of today's Washington Post, the editor, Harold Meyerson, who's with American Prospect magazine, has this piece where he's basically trying to make the case that that this all falls straight in a one-for-one progression from Jim Crow and the, you know, and the racist past of the South and all that sort of thing. And I find those sorts of comparisons generally to be sort of dismissive of both arguments of blacks and arguments of gays, because they're just, it's not saying that one has a harder time and one has an easier time, but it's certainly true that they're just very different circumstances. And on the
I hate to agree with you, but I do.
and on the right, there's been this desperate struggle to figure out a way to talk about homosexuality. You know, some people want to call it like it's alcoholism. Some people want to say that it's like, you know, pedophilia. You know, there are those. Certainly, the more you get onto the social conservative sort of Christian right side, you'll be much more likely to have find people to call it, you know, basically a disease that you can be cured of and all of that sort of thing. And
that ground's shrinking a little bit.
It is shrinking. It's shrinking a great deal, I think. And I think one of the reasons why is that we've sort of seen the culture change on switch under our feet, which we can get to in a second. I do want to say one thing on this libertarian point. I'm a proud conservative, and actually I have most of my arguments with libertarians, not with liberals these days. And I think that one of the problems with the conservatives' argument about this Supreme Court case is that libertarianism from the federal government is a problem. And the way you solve arguments about people who want to use the federal government to change people's lives, to pronounce upon how society should be organized, is you leave these sorts of questions to states and local communities who come up with their own solutions. Now, I think sodomy laws are idiotic and a waste of time, and I'm with Clarence Thomas on that. But there are lots of things that are bad that are also constitutional. And the problem that conservatives have with the Supreme Court's approach is that it didn't take a libertarian approach. The libertarian approach would be, if you talk to like a lot of libertarians, is that it's not the federal government that should be deciding these issues. It's supposed to be devolving these sorts of questions to the lowest levels where people in their own communities can come up with ways to organize life.
But that's not the way the system works. The system works from the local level on up to the Supreme Court.
Right. But a strict reading of the Constitution and a proper conservative Supreme Court would have at least done what Justice O'Connor wanted to do. It would not have made these sweeping, glorious pronouncements that I understand why have a lot of gay rights activists very happy. But the problem, and we can get off the Supreme Court, I'm glad to, but the problem the conservatives have with this Supreme Court, with this decision, with the affirmative action decision and others, is that basically the Supreme Court and people like Justice Kennedy in particular have decided that they are on a national commission to assure that we live in a nice society, not a commission, not a nine justices who read the Constitution for what it says. And that's the problem.
Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, a little bit more about how we got to where we are right now and whether or not the path ahead is one straight to same-sex marriage. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon, and this hour we're talking about the fallout from the decision late last week, the Supreme Court, on the Lawrence versus Texas case, the one that threw out sodomy laws, not just in that state, but effectively nationwide, and how that is resonating not only within the gay and lesbian community, but how we see it changing the country and how it is that we got here. With me on the program, Jonah Goldberg, editor-at-large of the web magazine National Review Online. E.J. Graff is author of What Is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution, a book which is you'll now see in a lot of women's studies courses in the United States. And E.J., I want to begin with you because in one piece of the writing of yours that I read, you were talking about The Georgia case, 1986, Bowers versus Hardwick, where the judges ruled in that case, yes, sodomy was a crime and the police should do everything that they can to protect us and our society from that. 1986, I mean, it's, what, it's the math, 17 years ago is not a long time for us to move from that judgment to what was said last week. It seems like a dramatic change in such a short period of time.
It is. But you have to remember that 1986, Bowers shocked everyone. Bowers shocked mainstream people. Bowers shocked gay people. It pretty much drove us, well, I was going to say drove us out of our houses, and it started sending money like crazy. People started sending money like crazy.
It was a galvanizing decision.
It was incredibly galvanizing. It was like being... It was like being punched in the stomach to have the Supreme Court say in language that's really shocking to read that we were not really full citizens. We were essentially criminals. But it was so out of sync with all the rest of their jurisprudence. It really brought a screeching halt to the line of privacy decisions that they had, saying, yes, people should be free to make love without making babies in Griswold versus Connecticut and
Eisenstadt. But talk to me about the way the rest of the country, not so much the people who are in tune with each court case, but I mean,
yes,
it seems to me that there are probably a lot of people who are ticked off with the decision last Friday, but they're not out in the streets marching. You see a few hellfire and damnation signs, but something's changed in the country in that period of time too.
We won the culture war. I mean, we won a very narrow thing, we being only lesbians and gay men, certainly not progressives or leftists. The conservatives won the rest of the culture. But lesbians and gay men won the part of the culture war that was about, do we have a right to live and love? And the Supreme Court got in sync with the country. It fell in line. Over the past 17 years, between Bowers and AIDS, that brought a huge number of gay people out into, I hesitate to say activism, but activism at least at the $25 a year check writing level, up to volunteering. And then gay rights organizations started winning a number of apparently small but really significant wins, enabling people here and there to still have custody of their children after they came out, or at least visit them instead of being banned from them for the rest of their lives.
And Jonah, in your view, is this the court following where society had already gone?
In many respects, I think it is. In some ways, I sort of look at it like things like child labor, where, you know, societies generally ban things once they're generally on the way out culturally. No one would have thought to ban child labor in this country until basically it was disappearing and was down to, I've seen some studies to say it was down to the last 5%. And the people who didn't have their children in labor and had them in school said, this is an outrage. We can't do this anymore. And you see that trend around the world with sweatshops and all those sorts of things. And I think you see the same thing with gays, where gays have basically won most of their victories retail. These haven't been legal victories. These have been victories that they won at the office because people work with gays. People go to the park with gays. People, know them in their daily lives. And they've sort of won the culture war, and at least in the major urban centers, in the sort of the coastal places, sort of the blue states, they've won the culture war in many ways door to door. And I think you just read that the culture war, I don't know if the right has won the culture war everywhere else. I certainly don't see that. But I think that in some ways the culture war is in abeyance someplace else, in other places, partly because the war on terrorism has distracted a lot of people on the right to other things.
But if I take what you're saying and what EJ is saying, and EJ, I'll put this to you, I think you could make the case that whatever happened in the Supreme Court decision on Friday isn't going to change very much, because precisely as Jonah's saying, a lot of people don't spend much of their waking hours worrying about what's happening with homosexuality in America. I would be surprised if neighbors are going to say, hey, guess what, honey? The folks live next door aren't actually breaking the law every time they have the bedroom door closed. We should have them over for a barbecue. You know, in that sense, what's really changed?
Well, in that way, Jonah's right. I mean, they've already had us over for the barbecue, and that's in part why the Supreme Court was sort of had to come along with this kind of decision. It was so out of sync with the country and so out of sync with jurisprudence in the rest of the world. We were really the last developed country with any sodomy laws on the books at all. The rest of the world considers them human rights violations. But I would disagree that it entirely divides into red state, blue state in this way. I mean, Walmart just came to Walmart this morning announced anti-discrimination policy against lesbians and gay men.
Pretty crafty West Coast lobbyists with their thumbscrews tightening down on Walmart. I don't think they came to that just because they thought it was a good idea.
I don't think it was just activists. I mean, women are organizing against Walmart for really horrible employment policies right now against women. No, it was because this is a pretty cheap way to be in sync with the culture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
88% of people think that that's the right thing to do.
And
Walmart's very mainstream. They're going for their mainstream buyers. They wouldn't have done it if they thought they were going to alienate their constituency.
Jonah, the news this morning that the folks at the Cook County Courthouse in Illinois will be accepting registration for same-sex unions sometime later this summer. Is it a straight line from where we are now to same-sex marriage?
Well, see, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I agree entirely that the Lawrence decision doesn't mean a huge deal in terms of day-to-day life in a whole range of things. But in one area where it does mean a great deal is that it has really greased the skids for gay marriage in at least one specific legal sense, and that sodomy laws were the linchpin that a lot of other laws hung on. You could claim that you couldn't allow this or you couldn't allow that because if you were committing sodomy, you were a criminal. And it played in things like divorce proceedings and all sorts of other stuff. And we're going to lose. I mean, there were some positive things that we lost with these sodomy laws as well, in terms of being able to try child molesters. It's nothing to do with gay straight stuff, but there were lots of things where if you couldn't get them on the big offense, you could get them on a lesser offense. Sort of like the same thing with drug laws. Those are going to be rewritten as well. But in terms of the gay marriage thing, it becomes very difficult. All of a sudden, this is one of the last sort of footholds in a legalistic argument against gay marriage. And I think Scalia, I mean, that's, as you said in your intro, the gay rights people agree with Justice Scalia that this makes same-sex marriage a lot easier, just as a legal proposition.
So, EJ, is that next?
Oh, absolutely. As my father said, from your mouth to God's ears, Antonin, it's absolutely next. I have a friend who's one of the gay civil rights lawyers who sent me a little email saying, she's having trouble in press conferences. All she wants to do is chant love and marriage. You know, first comes love, then comes marriage. I mean, that's absolutely next. No question.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation. We're going first to Newport News, Virginia. Justin's joining us. Hi, Justin.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I just wanted to set the background a bit.
Yeah.
I am a born-again Christian. I'm conservative right, although you could probably say that right is becoming kind of a weak term because I really don't agree with a lot of the right on a lot of the financial policies and that sort of thing. But when it comes down to it, of course, I'm morally right. I just want to make a couple of points. First of all, some of your guests may find this surprising, but I don't really know that the anti-sodomy laws in and of themselves are really all that good, because I think they tend to veil what the real issue is for a conservative Christian. I mean,
what's the real issue for a conservative Christian?
The real issue is what it comes down to. This ain't going to be popular with your guests or even with you, sir, but what it comes down to is that for a Christian, this isn't a question of someone's choice. It's a question of what our scripture tells us is right or wrong. So if we see something as being given to us by God as saying, look, this is wrong, then it's wrong. It's not, we can't say, well, so much for what you say, you know, we think it a different way.
Just
so
quick question for you, Justin, before I let EJ speak on this, and that is, we've heard nothing from the president on this. This is a man who, for the past couple of years, has been somewhat of a spokesman for the born-again Christian moral right position that you're taking. Are you surprised that he said nothing about this?
No, not really. Not really. Because, like I said, we could almost have a whole other talk show on this, but I'm not really so convinced that the right really represents true Christianity anyway, because of a lot of I'm not going to get into that, but there's a lot of...
Okay, I'd like to let EJ in here on the scriptural point that you're making.
Okay.
This brings me to the metaphor I would like to make rather than the Black civil rights movement metaphor. I think that what lesbians and gay men want is very comparable to freedom of religion. I absolutely respect Justin's right to believe what he believes. It's not what I believe, and I want the freedom to live by what I believe. I mean, I may, in my private life, believe that fundamentalist Christian beliefs are wrong and perhaps even bad, but I respect Justin's right to hold those beliefs.
Do you think that the Supreme Court is creating a legal playing field where it's saying, yes, you're entitled to your point of view, mm-hmm. Justin his, and
the government can't arrest either of us.
Justin.
Well, I mean, I agree in that so much as to say that people do have the right to for self-determination how they're going to live their lives. But by the same respect, it's one of those things where I reserve the right to oppose and not be happy with the decisions that are made, but I also realize that I do live in a republic where, you know, laws are made by legislative branch and that sometimes things are interpreted judicially, and that's just the way it goes. But that doesn't mean that I have to go along with it and say I'm happy with it.
Justin, just one quick question before I let you go. If same-sex marriage is, in fact, the next battle in this war, is that something that you would get personally involved in arguing against for the reasons that you're explaining?
Well, I mean, as far as whether I'd pick it on the street or something,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know, because getting back to the background, I mean, being a Christian, I kind of see the future of things laid out in a certain way anyway. I mean, the scripture kind of tells us how things are going to go, so I don't really know that it's my job to dedicate my whole life to one issue. That's,
all right,
you know,
Justin, I'm going to let you go. Thanks for your
call.
Thank
you, sir. All righty.
Jonah, help us out with where you see this going politically. I mean, Bush has been quite silent about this, but I was thinking earlier, as EJ was talking about the way that the Georgia case galvanized gay and lesbian rights advocates, whether or not you think the Lawrence versus Texas decision stands a chance at galvanizing the people who want constitutional amendments or whatever it is they want to prevent same-sex marriage.
Oh, I think that's already happening. I think that this is given a real fundraising boost, a real sort of energy boost to a lot of people on the Christian right. These are debates that we're having on the conservative side from all over the spectrum about how to deal with these issues. And for me, one of the things that concerns me a great deal, and what a lot of people are talking about, is that we're going to have this be another Roe v. Wade. And the fear there is...
Do you mean that in terms of a political issue that everybody has to take a position on?
Right.
That remains...
Well, the chief argument... Well, there are all sorts of arguments about Roe v. Wade, but one of the salient one here is that what happened in 73 was basically the Supreme Court plucked this issue out of the democratic process. So there were all sorts of states that were going one way on abortion. There were other states that were going another way on abortion. And instead, it decided to have a one-size-fits-all approach all across the country. And what that did was that that turned it into a national issue. And so you had pro-lifers turn into a national movement, and it could fundraise at a national level. And you had pro-choicers turn into a national movement and fundraise at a national level. And that's why it became such a hot button issue in presidential campaigns, and it became all the screaming and all the yelling. And the fear for me is that, well, one of my fears, and I think it's a legitimate one, is that if
you
have...
Let me interrupt you here. I mean, aside from running against the libertarian part of you that would like all these issues settled at the local level, what's wrong with having the nation debate big moral questions?
Oh, I don't think there's anything wrong with the nation debating big moral questions. I'm one of these guys who thinks that everyone who wants the tone to be, you know, calmed down and have bipartisan consensus don't understand what a democracy is about. I totally support screaming and yelling. But the problem is that in the case of abortion, you made it a national issue when it should not have been. People should be able to organize their lives in their local communities as they like. And if it turns out that some community has a standard that you don't like, this is the most mobile country in the history of the universe, you can move. Or you can change the local laws as you see fit through the democratic process. What's going to happen here is you're going to tell a whole bunch of people in Wyoming and in Nebraska that they have to honor same-sex marriages, and you're going to turn this into another national screaming match. And I would rather see it. I don't understand, since first of all, the data isn't great about what same-sex marriage is actually going to do. What is wrong with going back to the laboratories of democracy idea of saying, well, look, you know, in Massachusetts, they allow people, they allow gays to marry, but, you know, in Montana, they don't. If that's unfair to the people, to gays in Montana, well, so be it. If that's unfair to fundamentalist Christian conservatives in Massachusetts, so be it. Have those arguments at the local level where you can at least see the people that you're proposing to offend in the face. But when you make it a national issue, you make it into a national screaming match and you demonize both sides.
And one of the things, EJ, that keeps getting repeated is that every candidate for political office starting last Friday is going to now have to take a position on same-sex marriage, on the Lawrence case. What are your thoughts about doing this at a national level? Do you have any of the reservations that Joan is talking about?
Well, I think he's a little bit off in the sense that Lawrence is not like Roe. I mean, Lawrence is coming at the end. The nation is essentially decided.
I mean, let me interrupt really quickly. I agree with that. I basically was talking about if the federal government establishes gay marriage across the country.
Well, so what I was going to say is I don't see that on the horizon at all. We haven't been able to win in a single state yet. So so let me then distinguish marriage from
abortion.
Well,
what's
abortion?
A win? I mean, a civil union is a step in the direction of...
Civil unions are available to 0.02% of the population so long as they do not leave the state of Vermont, which I don't know if you've looked at your maps lately, is fairly small. So, and what it can do is also fairly limited. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's very, very slight. It's nothing near marriage. Let's just look at the difference between abortion and marriage. You get an abortion, it's over. You don't have to go home and then say, will you treat me as someone who's had an abortion? In fact, you don't want that to happen. Marriage, however, say Anne and Mary get married in Massachusetts, and they go visit Mary's family in Utah. What happens if Anne gets hit by a car and they have to go to the hospital? Does Mary get to take care of Anne? I mean, that's the kind of question we're talking about. Will the Salt Lake City Hospital then recognize them as married for the purpose of making end-of-life medical decisions?
It's a part of the conversation that I want to continue when we come back after the break, whether or not the conversation about same-sex marriage is principally an economic one having to do with Social Security benefits, or whether or not we're talking about that sacrament that Christians talk about when they're talking about marriage. 1-800-423-8255 is the number for you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear some of your thoughts on our conversation about same-sex marriage in America and whether or not that's the inevitable destination started most recently with the Supreme Court ruling on Friday. We'll take our next call from Boston. Trish is on the line. Hi, Tricia.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, you're welcome. What do you think?
Well, I'm thrilled. Up until not too long ago, I didn't even think that I could ask for marriage. I guess I just saw it as something that would never happen.
You're in a lesbian relationship, right, Tricia?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And the problem is that my partner is in the armed services. And right now, even if gay marriage was legal, if we did have a gay marriage, then...
Then she'd be out of the military.
Then she'd be out of the military. And I don't see it as much as a Social Security thing, even though I would love the same rights that come along with marriage. I see it as just an equality thing, just being able to have the same standard as anyone else, being able to have the same.
Excuse me, Tricia, do you think that an approval somewhere in America of same-sex marriages is inevitable at this point?
Well, I'm 24 now, and I can see it sometime in my life. I'm not saying it's going to be in the next 3 years, but I do see it sometime.
And if you were to put your shoulder behind an issue, would it be that, or would it be getting the military off its don't ask, don't tell policy to change that?
Well, I see the don't ask, don't tell policy as affecting my life more than the marriage issue because we have to live in such secrecy She actually doesn't live in this area. But the thought that anything getting out could possibly jeopardize her career is a very scary prospect.
Jonah, let me just get a bit of a political sense from you about how the social conservatives are looking at the battles ahead. Is it all about same-sex marriage, or is it, you know, basically any of the hot buttons, whether it's the military or the workplace, that sort of thing?
Well, I tell you, the workplace thing I just don't hear about very often. And it's interesting, the gays in the military issue splits very differently in terms of the conservatives it bothers than the marriage issue. And when you think about it, it makes total sense because marriage is... you know, we can have huge arguments about what marriage is, but at least from the social conservative's perspective, marriage is a religious institution which predates Western civilization, predates democracy, is in the Christian faith and in the Jewish faith. It is very central to all sorts of divine imperatives, and the idea that the law and sort of social engineering types can rewrite what it means offends a very specific kind of person who on the right who believes in whose religion and religious values informs what they do. The gays in the military issue is not a totally different group. I'm sure there's a lot of overlap, but it bothers conservatives who are much more interested in national security issues, who have very clear views about what it would mean for the military effectiveness of the military, and who generally bristle at the idea of using the military as a palette for social engineering of any kind. But they're different groups.
Jonah, ours is the last military last developed military that does not allow lesbians and gay men to serve openly. I mean, the Israeli Defense Forces lost a case in 1997 about giving a pension to a same-sex widower.
So what are you saying about priorities in terms of battles yet to be fought then?
I don't think anybody thinks that the military policy is going to change under Bush. So that's... I'm sure the Service Member Defense League Network,
whatever
they are.
Save your poster boards.
Exactly. It's going to be tackled. It has to be tackled. Terrible things are being done to people who, for some reason, want to die for their country. And that's wrong, and it has to be tackled.
So why do you think gay marriage is going to be any more successful under this administration?
Because it's not up to this administration. That's a state-by-state question. Right now, we have a case in front of the Massachusetts Supreme Court that will probably be decided within next month. And it's looking very good that we'll be able to get married here in Massachusetts within the next month. That will set off cross-recognition battles across the country. I don't think anybody is immediately hoping it will go to the Supreme Court.
And Jonah, I keep hearing from people in Washington that something needs to be done about the overactive judicial decisions here, that gays and lesbians are achieving in the courts what they could never achieve politically. Do they believe that when they say that?
Oh, I think absolutely, yes. Sure, I believe that. I mean, if the Defense of Marriage Act or the Federal Marriage Amendment or any of these things go up before legislatures, they will pass in many places with very large numbers. But all you need is one judge somewhere to say the legislature is wrong and to legislate from the bench. Now, the substance of these things we can argue about, you know, for a very, very long time, but there is something, just as a procedural point, which affects the kind of country we live in, there is something problematic where you have unelected sort of robed masters deciding what kind of country we're going to live in, regardless of what the democratic bodies have.
Jonah, I think that's entirely a red herring. In Hawaii and Alaska, where judges tried to go ahead of their population, constitutional amendments were passed overruling them. I think if it happens here in Massachusetts, and I think most bets are that it will, although nobody can read their minds, it's going to stay because the majority of Massachusetts thinks it's fine and the rest don't really care if their neighbors, the two girls living next door, are married or not married.
I want to get back to our phone lines. Tricia, thanks for that call. Next to Louisville, Kentucky, and Michael's joining us. Hi, Michael.
Hello, everyone.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I've got a quick comment. Actually, in less than a month, one of the churches of the country, the Episcopal Church, is actually going to have a major convention, and the issue of blessing of same-sex unions is on the table. And so I think it's interesting, kind of in parallel with the civil actions that are happening with the Supreme Court, also the kind of moral compass of the country is actually looking at this from a scriptural point, at least the Christian non-right, and kind of saying, you know, where do we stand on this? And I think if they do decide to go in favor, which some churches are kind of leaning towards, that's going to give a significant amount of firepower to the civil administrations to say, well, hey, if the church doesn't say it's wrong, then maybe we should go for it too.
And should the churches be leading on this one, Michael?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, sometimes the churches have kind of, I mean, they've followed on some cases and led on others. But I think that there's a lot of issues that have come before the church on this where they think that, at least some of them feel that they should indeed take a stance. I mean, I, like someone posed a question earlier, believe whether this is inevitable or not. I really believe that this is an inevitable thing, and the church eventually will come around, as will the civil governments. But whether it's going to happen this year, or in 3 years, or in 6 years, or in 10 years, really is the only question, really.
All right, Michael, thanks for your call.
50. I mean,
maybe longer than
I'm looking for 3 years for all the religions to change. I mean, it took 50 to 75 years for the mainstream Protestant denominations to make up their minds about contraception and divorce.
All right, but this is a church that has nominated an openly gay bishop, the Episcopal Church, in New Hampshire, I think. I'm not sure if I've got that right. But, I mean, Jonah, it chips away at the foundation that the religious right has to stand on if the churches are even moving ahead of the courts and the politicians here.
I agree with that. And look, I mean, one of the main reasons I think I'm on this show today is because I wrote a column basically saying that gays have won this battle,
right,
and that conservatives need to, you know, my problem, and I agree with the Christian right on a lot of issues, but on this one, I do think it is sort of as a matter of social policy, I think it is nuts to condemn particularly gay men. It's funny how lesbians sort of fall out of this argument, but it's sort of nuts as a society to condemn gay men for their promiscuity and at the same time give them no institution with which they can sort of live stable monogamous lives.
But you're against same-sex marriage.
I'm against gay marriage. I'm not against civil unions. And
isn't that sort of like saying that you would agree to somebody getting married in the church but not City Hall?
I mean, a
heterosexual couple?
One of the things we're going to see from all of this is basically a move towards privatizing marriage and getting it out of state sanction in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure that's a bad thing. It's an interesting experiment. But I think it is a perfectly legitimate argument to say that marriage is defined by the union of a man and a woman. And that doesn't mean that I'm not sympathetic to, you know, lifetime same-sex partners who want to be able to visit their dying loved ones in hospitals or inherit their estate. I mean, I think those are perfectly legitimate things, and I don't see why, as a conservative, I should be opposed to private contracts between individuals.
Private contracts aren't portable. The word marriage goes to every country. A Canadian couple gets married. One of them happens to own some property, a Tuscan vineyard, and she dies. Does her widow then automatically inherit that vineyard? Well, you can go to court with that in Italy on the word marriage, but you can't go to court with that on the word civil union.
I understand, but I'm not sure I want to define a sweeping and radical change in a central institution of Western civilization to make sure that some woman gets a Tuscan vineyard. I mean, these are not these examples, while they may be heartbreaking and unfair to individuals, are not the basis upon which to sort of say that we should therefore throw out, you know, these huge sweeping institutions willy-nilly. I think that,
that's what we're trying to do.
Well,
I
we're going to have unfair circumstances in life. That's why they call it life.
And that's why that we have civil marriage as opposed to religious marriage. I'm not saying that the Catholic Church should recognize divorce, but they do have to recognize that civil marriage allows divorce. So civil marriage is very baggy, very pluralist. It lets in atheists who just would not even want God spoken about at their Justice of the Peace moment. It lets in Orthodox Jews who believe that only the man can grant a divorce. It lets in an enormous number of people who dramatically disagree about what the meaning of what the religious meaning is of that word. marriage has changed its definitions unbelievably dramatically over the past thousands and thousands of years. And I would like to send you my book, Jonan. I'm going to.
That's fine.
But when we talk about same-sex marriage, I want to come back to a question that I posed earlier in the program, though, EJ. Are we talking simply about something that is going to provide the same economic benefits to a same-sex couple that it will to a heterosexual couple? Because that seems like a fairly cold and calculated move towards that, and maybe the only way to get there. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying I would have thought that the move for marriage had a lot more to do with the way that that couple was seen by their neighbors or felt about their own union.
Well, I think that I already have that marriage. I mean, I had a ceremony. I get the anniversary cards from the in-laws. I mean, a lot of people feel that they are already married in the social sense, mm-hmm. in the religious sense within their religious communities, whether that might be a Reform Judaism congregation or whether it's a Unitarian congregation. What we don't have are all the civil law protections that go under that legal word marriage. Okay. And we don't need the religions to redefine what they think.
And Jonah, this is the ground upon which it would seem to me it's most difficult for Republicans or social conservatives to say no to same-sex marriage, because the rights as citizens is something that ranks pretty high in both those groups' charters.
I agree. It's a tough chicken or the egg thing. You know, I've spoken to a number of gays and gay rights groups and that sort of thing, and they'll say, well, you know, we invest marriage with all of these benefits and mechanisms, and therefore it's unfair to deny us access to it. And social conservatives say, well, we invest this institution with all of these things because this institution is so important. And you have it's a tough difference of perspective. But I think the social conservatives, their response to to gays for the last 30 years has been basically to dig themselves into a hole, and when they run into a problem, to dig faster. And I think they've lost on this, and they're refusing to find a compromise. They don't want a half a loaf. They'd rather be beautiful losers on this, and I think it's sort of tragic.
Well, we don't want half a loaf either, and I really think it is inevitable, although it's going to take a long time. I mean, I really would say 50 years, although that may be very, very pessimistic.
We'll have you back to talk about it before that period of time. EJ, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
E.J. Graff, author of What is Marriage For? The Strange Social History of Our Most Intimate Institution. Jonah Goldberg, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jonah's editor-at-large of the web magazine National Review Online. Connection listeners, you're welcome to continue the conversation in the forum section of our website, theconnection.org. We'll have a link on our website to some of Jonah's writing on this if you want to follow that up. And that's it for this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.